Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Peace seems to be such a ubiquitous, universal value that the need to secure it is taken for granted, regardless of the divisions that underlie it. Peace at all costs, isn't this exactly what makes the specter of the Third World War so palpable today? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Pino Cabras, former member of the Italian Parliament and editor of online portal Megachip. Mr. Cabras, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, I know that you've been involved in peace movements for quite some time, but simply having peace as a value is not enough for ensuring it. You know, a lot of work goes into peace building, especially when you have so many divergent views and interests as we have in the world today. Do you think peace and authentic diversity, by which I mean economic, political, ideological, cultural, religious diversity, do you think they are actually compatible?
Peace is something that could be declined in a naive way, but I think is a fundamental resource of thinking towards the future in this era. We have passed the threshold of Hiroshima. So the humanity has in its hands its own survival. Every decision in many important issues now is a question of a peace, of war, and of survival. Mm-hmm. So it's not a question of being peaceful at any cost, but to build an infrastructure in terms of culture, of media, of interpretation of the current world, of new movements that have to share a vision, mm-hmm. even maintaining the differences between countries, civilizations, cultural idea, and ideologies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I know that you've written that for following World War II, the world has been tittering on the brink of Third World War, with weapons becoming increasingly more sophisticated and increasingly more destructive. Do you think our thinking about peace and what goes into it evolved in sync with this proliferation of weapons?
I think in the last 30 years, the ruling classes of many countries lost their ability to understand the threats we are facing that are very dangerous for the survival of humanity. During the Cold War, there was an awareness in many leaders of the Western countries, for example, even if they were involved in a Cold War, in a war of confrontation between ideologies or even geopolitical blocs, they were aware of the limits of their action. Now, I think the economic thinking, the ruling out the questions of military awareness of the political leader, giving all the military questions to the military people, has been a problem for understanding the risks we are facing now.
I don't think it applies to Russia. Maybe I'm biased here, but you know, my country has lost millions of people to wars that traditionally came to us from the West, from Western Europe. And I think for years, Russia has tried and pushed for some sort of security arrangement on the continent, understanding the limits to its own ambitions, understanding you know, prerogatives of other countries. But there is a key interest in having some sort of security architecture within the bigger Europe. Why do you think this whole notion of you know, shared security for all was rejected by Western elites? Because I think it was actively rejected by what they started doing in Ukraine.
Yeah, the European agenda has been taken over in the last decades from different agendas. from the Anglo-Saxon one, that is far from the war scenario under centered points of view, even if now...
You mean geographically far?
Yeah, geographically far. Mm-hmm. This is an illusion, because now the weapons and the missiles are capable to reach every part of the planet. But the sensation of many leaders of the Anglo-Saxon countries is that they can manage some puppets in Europe. And these puppets are willing to be managed in these circumstances. For economic reasons, for many exchanges that are very irresponsible. Mm-hmm. And the other group of countries that took over the European agenda is the Baltic group. They changed the perception of security in Europe. Now they consider the security on a basis of confrontation that was not the principle, the main idea of the Western countries until 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And this is becoming a problem. There is a contradiction inside the core of the vision of the European Union countries.
Mm-hmm. Now, you previously called the current security crisis over Ukraine the third attempt to somehow pry Russia out of Europe, coming in the footsteps of Napoleon and Hitler. And as I'm sure you know, both the French and the German invasions went pretty badly for the countries that initiated them. But now we have Russia positioned against the entire West, and not only Western Europe, but also the United States behind it with, combined power of their militaries. How do you intuit the outcome of this conflagration? Where do you think it's going? And who do you think will ultimately emerge as, if not a winner, because I think everybody is losing, then at least on top of it?
Yeah, we are losing the notion that the European security is an indivisible entity, something that is shared by West and Russia. We have a common space that is based on two lungs that have to breathe together. Otherwise, there is a confrontation that could easily escalate. And this is a lose-lose scenario. The possibility of survival for Europe is to share the notion that we are in the same pattern of security. We have to establish rules for controlling each other and having mutual security. And this has been done for decades in many ways with the treaties that now were abandoned, and this is a very dangerous escalation of a vortex of situation that could destroy the mutual security. So it's fundamental to recover this idea of a common house in Europe.
I agree with you 100%, but I think European policy vis-a-vis security in Europe changed not just a year or two ago with the active start of the Russian operation in Ukraine. I think you are one of the very few European observers who noted that the shift happened long before, in 2013 and 2014. And ever since, and even before that, the West was actively militarizing Ukraine, sending weapons, but also investing and cultivating specifically anti-Russian elites, elites that are inimical towards Russia, who don't see any possibility of peaceful coexistence, let alone mutually beneficial trade or exchanges. And it's not a declaration of war per se, but it's clearly an adversarial policy. And what I wonder about is, why do you think the West chose to pursue it? Why it chose to push you know, NATO towards Russia, instead of, let's say, even keeping the status quo. Okay, we are not friends, perhaps we are not partners, but at least we could live on some sort of speaking terms with one another. Why the decision towards, you know, more active confrontation was taken, as far as you understand?
Yeah, there is a sort of bad lecture of what happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Soviet Union wasn't a nation, was a melting pot, very complicated, with a mosaic of ethnic entities. It was shaped republic after republic in a global balance in which there was the interest of the Soviet Union. After the collapse, we lost the center of gravity, but we didn't lose the melting pot that was very complicated. The worst thing to do in this case is to foster and boast the nationalism, to create a contraposition between ethnic groups, Russia and the others, while we have to have an idea of a post-Soviet new balance that is quite respectful of the melting pot and the differences, with no nationalistic solutions that go back to the 19th century, is something that is not suitable, that doesn't fit to the modern European, especially for the situation of the post-Soviet areas. So it's important to think Ukraine together with the Baltic nations and together with Russia and together with the European balance as a whole. Any Russophobic weaponization of culture is something that conduct the Europe towards the war.
Mr. Kavros, I totally agree with you. I think it's a moral practice to begin with. But what I'm interested in is the strategic and tactical benefit of it for Europe, because maybe we are biased here in Russia, but we always thought that even during Soviet times, the Soviet-European cooperation was very beneficial for many European nations, including Italy, including Germany, including France. What's the point of
a Russian city? There is a Russian city that is called Togliatti, that was the name of the leader of the Communist Party in Italy. And there was the factories for building the Ladas, other important cars. And this was a joint venture between the capitalist Italy, the NATO member Italy, and Russia. So the Russia in the Soviet era. I think this is a basis very strong for continuing in having trade and relationship in all the spectrum of the activities.
And not just Togliatti, for example, I can still say that Italian is one of the most popular foreign languages in Russian. And people, you know, in my own hometown of St. Petersburg, we have Italian streets, you know, built by Italian architects. Italian culture is still worshipped by many Russians. So the connections are very strong there. And that's why it's very difficult to understand why many Europeans would support this image of enemy in Russia, because, you know, sure, we have differences, but we never treated you badly, so to say.
Yeah, I mean, the TV show in the beginning of the year with the Italian sounds was very spectacular. It was a sort of love from Russia to the Italian culture, the Italian lifestyle, etc. And there are a lot of connections. I don't even mention them because the people have a sympathy in many aspects. Reminds me that there is a shift between the public opinion that is in favor of peace, in favor of dialogue, and some tiny ruling classes, but that are very dominant in the choices and in the sound of the media system.
Okay. Well, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Pino Cabras, former member of the Italian Parliament and editor of online portal Megachip. Mr. Cabras, in one of your articles, you wrote about the quote, the dignity of interest in and rights. And I think dignity is such an interesting word. It's actually Latin in origin, which I'm sure is close to your heart. And it means taking or accepting worth. Do you think Europe accepts its own worth separate from that of its American partners?
Now the general perception of the ruling classes in Europe is of being part of a collective West that weaponized its vision of the world, that considered the international community in the tiny perimeter of the Western countries, the Western European countries and some other country like Japan or Korea. And this is something that is hypocrite towards the vision of other civilizations that have equal dignity, that have a vision that shaped themselves in confrontation with the modernity. The modern era changed a lot. China, India, even the future of Africa is different now in terms of how it could be thought in this moment. And so there is no primacy of the Western spiritual monad. I think we need a lay approach to the question in order to make all the parts of the humanity can play equally.
You've been talking about the dominance of the so-called deep state or the European elites that do not prioritize immediate or economic interests of the Italian or other European peoples. But I think there has been some movement towards independence. For example, even you yourself have been a member of that movement, a five-star movement, which came to power in 2018 on the platform of challenging austerity and challenging some of the precepts of neoliberalism, only to return to the same old policies later on. I wonder if any meaningful, authentic policy change is even possible in Europe in this day and age through democratic procedures, because it seems that whenever people exercise their right to vote, led by certain promises of politicians, those promises are not honored later on.
Yeah, the French economist Fitoussi said that in Europe, you can change the governments, you can change the policies. This is the idea that is in the core of Ursula von der Leyen and all the big bananas of the European Union. They decide for the people. They can observe the release of the protesters in France, but these protesters cannot achieve a change in the government, if not in a revolutionary way. So it's quite a conservative view, the one is prevailing in Europe, and it's very hard to change the core of power if you don't challenge the instrument. For example, the currency, the euro, is a sort of a cage that is impossible to overthrow.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about the monetary structure, I know you're in favor of inventing some new solutions, and you spoke in favor of getting out of euro without unleashing turmoil. Given the rather entrenched state of both the Italian and the European economy, do you think this kind of a divorce from Europe without turmoil is even possible?
It's not very easy to do something like this. Even if now we are seeing that the dollarization in the world is going very fast, and things that were unthinkable until 1 year ago now are in real laws, in new agendas of the governments. So it depends on the decisions of the Anglo-Saxon country about losing power. If they decide that all the ships have to sink, this is a problem.
You wrote before that the Italian deep state for years has been associated with the Anglo-American finance capital and a faction of central European industrial class dominated by the German value chain. But I think it's pretty evident, and that happened over the last maybe year or two, that the Americans have made a decision to throw the Germans under the bus. You know, they are trying to, you know, get all the industrial capacity back to the United States and leave many European partners without access to cheap energy sources. What kind of effect do you think that's going to have on both larger Europe and Italy in particular?
The shift between the Western European economy and the Russia, that means also the Eurasian dimension, is something that has only a way of for Europe, is deindustrialization, the end of the modern German, Italian, French industry as we have known until now. So there is a new balance in which there is a dominance from the United States, for example, in the energy supply chain. And this is very costly for the industry. Somebody is thinking to create a new economy of war as a solution for the new shift. And this is very dangerous because this means war.
For years, the Russians have spoken about Europe from Lisbon to Vladivostok, with Russia serving as this massive land bridge between Western Europe and Southeast Asia. But Moscow is clearly now more concentrated on integrating into bigger Eurasia, getting along with China, getting along with India, Pakistan, even Afghanistan, you know, many other countries that inhabit that region. But this is an interesting dimension. Do you think Europe can exist without being integrated into a bigger Eurasia? And do you think Europe can be integrated into the bigger Eurasia without changing its values first? Because within the Eurasian, various Eurasian organizations, there are totally different sets of values that from the ones that European politicians or European elites profess.
I don't think the obstacle are the values, because Europe and Russia, for example, have a common ground. They could easily understand themselves in many aspects, from culture, music, way of life, living. It's not a question of ideological differences, even if someone could exasperate this aspect.
Now, many economists, including European economists, are forecasting a pretty rapid decline of living standards within many European countries that traditionally have enjoyed pretty good lives, including Germany, including Italy. And I want to ask you specifically about the Germans, because they like their Ordnung, and historically when their social structure got too much out of balance, or, you know, they lost their usual dignity, their usual comforts, they responded in pretty aggressive, militaristic, and sometimes inhumane ways. I understand that history never repeats itself exactly, but do you think, how do you think your German neighbors may react to this new economic situation, economic and industrial situation that is brought about by the conflict in Ukraine?
Even if history is not a mechanic machinery, there is something that could happen very dangerously in losing the economic power of Germany. Because, for example, the middle classes have been the backbone of modern democracy in Italy, in Germany, in France. And there was a balance that could make that people achieved a lot of new securities about their own lives. Destroying the middle class, destroying all this backbone of democracy, creates the conditions for something that could call for a strong man that decides for everyone. And this is not a question of being the classical Germany that reacts in this way, but general economic crisis could trigger a problem of this dimension.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the European elites understand that you know, their time and privilege and power is ultimately conditioned on you know, the perception and the quality of life of ordinary people in Europe?
I think this is quite a simple equation. The only way to achieve the transition in energy, in a new economy, in a new era of abundance, is to have a transition mean in the oil and gas of Russia and all the things that could be brokered by Russia in,
or for example, China.
Trade.
Let's not forget China as well, because there are now conversations about how Europe should build its relationship with China, whether it should be affected or dictated by the United States or not.
Yeah, we lost many chances in the last 2 years in trading with China. We can see the war in Syria or the war in Ukraine like two obstacles to the brief, to the Belt and Road Initiative, to the New Silk Road. China is the bigger power that is becoming bigger in this era, that could be even intermediated by Russia. And so it's very unclever from the European point of view to renounce to this role of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even for trading with China, for balancing the power of China.
Well, in order to reach that conclusion, one has to have a pretty broad scope of mind, and I thank you for exhibiting it today. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.